You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled According to Luke. This is lecture 7, entitled Christ, the Great Mystery of Earth Evolution. In the past few days, we pictured the Luke Gospel's most important beings and developed a comprehensive view of its spiritual foundations. One thing remains to be done, however. We must still trace the further evolution of Christ Jesus, the preeminent being in Earth's history. We must first recall what we have already heard. Christ Jesus, as described in the Luke Gospel, was born in bodily form as the Nathanic Jesus of the house of David. This child grew and developed until about age 12, when the being who had led Persian culture entered his body. Zarathustra's eye lived in the Nathanic Jesus's body from its 12th year onward. Our previous anthroposophic studies have prepared us to follow the evolution of this being more exactly. We know that the first important period in normal human development encompasses the first 7 years of life, the second years 7 to 14, the prepubescent years, and the next, years 14 to 21. A subsequent period lasts until year 28, and the next until 35. These time periods, however, do not begin and end with pedantic precision. For example, the important transition around the seventh year of human development actually occurs by degrees during the second dentition, and the other transitions are similarly gradual. My booklet, titled The Education of the Child in the Light of Spiritual Science, describes the transition in the seventh year in greater detail. This transition is an etheric birth of sorts. What happens then is comparable, on a higher level, to leaving the mother's womb at physical birth. Similarly, in the 14th year, at puberty, an astral birth occurs, and the individual's astral body is set free. If we trace human development with precision through the eyes of the spirit, it looks still more complicated. Important later transitions escape our ordinary observation. Today we tend to believe that individuals change relatively little after a certain age, but this belief is based on crude methods of observation. In reality, certain subtler changes in human development are evident to the appropriate modes of perception. The body that is fully born, when the protection of the mother's physical body is abandoned, actually includes only the child's physical body. In the first 7 years of life, only the physical body is fully emerged. In various lectures on education, I emphasized the importance of this fact, especially for teachers. Later, when the protection of the mother's etheric body is abandoned, the individual ether body is set free, and something similar happens to the astral body in the 14th year. Strictly speaking, however, a complete understanding of the human constitution is based on the further subdivisions of the human soul that are listed in my book titled Theosophy. The soul body, which forms a unity with the ether body or life body, is the first such subdivision. In precise terms, only the soul body is completely free before the 21st year. In the 21st year, the member that we call the sentient soul is gradually freed, while the mind soul or rational soul is freed at 28, and the consciousness soul only later. This is how human development progresses at present. If our observation of human life is guided by spiritual scientific insight, we are well aware of these developmental stages. All of humankind's great leaders have also always known why the 35th year is so important. As we learn at the very beginning of the Divine Comedy, the cosmic visions Dante recorded in his great epic occurred during his 35th year. Individuals at that developmental stage are fully able to use the faculties that relate to the soul-body, sentient soul, and mind-soul. Teachers of human development have always been aware of these subdivisions of the human soul. The times are shifted somewhat in Eastern cultures, accurately reflecting the somewhat different course of human development in the Orient. But the subdivisions are consistent throughout Western civilization. The Greeks, for example, simply used somewhat different words for the phenomena we know today. In describing the human soul, they too began with the ether body, which they called threptikon. They applied the very descriptive term aestheticon to what we call the soul body. The sentient soul was their orecticon, and the mind soul kineticon. And they called the consciousness soul, that most precious possession of modern human beings, dianoeticon. This is how human development appears to close observation. As a result of circumstances that I will at least partially explain today, the Nathanic Jesus developed somewhat more quickly. Puberty typically occurred earlier in that part of the world, and individually specific reasons also contributed to an earlier transition. Consequently, the change that normally occurs in a child's 14th year happened in Jesus' 12th year. Similarly, Jesus was 19 when he underwent the transition that normally occurs in the 21st year, and he was 26 and 33 at the 28 and 35-year transitions, respectively. Here is a chart of the development of the central being of earthly evolution. Please note that we are considering the body of the Nathanic Jesus, which Zarathustra's eye inhabited from the 12th year onward. What does that actually mean? It means simply that this mature, which as we know had experienced Zarathustra's destinies in different incarnations, cultivated the sentient body, sentient soul, and mind soul of the Nathanic Jesus as only a very mature eye could do. We must grasp the wondrous fact that the Zarathustra eye incarnated into the body of the Nathanic Jesus in the 12th year, developing Jesus' soul faculties with infinite subtlety. The soul body thus developed in Jesus looked out into the cosmos and beheld the spiritual being of the Ahura Mazda of old. His sentient soul harbored the knowledge and wisdom that human beings had gradually developed on the basis of Zarathustra's teachings about Ahura Mazda. And his mind soul learned to clothe everything that humankind had previously received only from external spiritual currents in easily understandable words and concepts. The Nathanic Jesus continued to develop under the influence of Zarathustra's eye until a new change occurred as his 30th year approached. Once again, as at puberty, a new eye filled the inner being of the Nathanic Jesus, but this time on a more universally significant level. Around the 30th year of Jesus' life, Zarathustra's eye had finished incorporating all the gains of earlier incarnations into his soul, and had developed his faculties to the highest possible level. This eye, knowing that it had completed its mission with regard to that soul, subsequently left the body of the Nathanic Jesus. As you recall, Zarathustra's eye had inhabited the body of the other Solomonic Jesus until approximately the 12th year of life. When Zarathustra's eye left him, the boy could not continue to develop but remained at his previous level, although admittedly he had achieved a rare and lofty degree of maturity while harboring such an exalted eye. Anyone who observed the Solomonic Jesus boy, even superficially, would have seen an extremely precocious child. But as soon as he was abandoned by Zarathustra's eye, the boy ceased to progress. A short time later, the mother of the Nathanic Jesus died. As her spiritual members were transported into the spiritual world, she took with her all the creative and eternally valuable forces of the Solomonic boy Jesus, who then died at approximately the same time. A very precious etheric covering separated from the physical body of the Solomonic Jesus at death. Since the ether body accomplishes most of its development after a child's seventh year of life, in the period between the seventh year and puberty, the forces of Zarathustra's eye had contributed to the development of this ether body. We know that when the ether body leaves the physical body at death, at the end of a normal human life, everything not of eternal value is stripped away, leaving an extract of the ether body to persist from one incarnation to the next. The greatest possible portion of the Solomonic Jesus' ether body had acquired eternal value, and so the Nathanic mother took his entire life body with her into the spiritual world. The ether body, however, sculpts and builds the human physical body. We can imagine the profound relationship between the Solomonic Jesus' ether body, now transported into the spiritual world, and Zarathustra's eye, which had been united with it for 12 years of earthly life. When Zarathustra's eye left the body of the Nathanic Jesus, the force of attraction between that eye and the former ether body of the Solomonic Jesus reasserted itself, and these two members came together to build a new physical body. Zarathustra's eye was so mature that it no longer had to pass through the Devakan. In a relatively short time, with the help of the ether body we have just described, this eye built a new physical body, resulting in the first birth of a being who subsequently reappeared repeatedly with relatively short intervals between physical death and rebirth. This being always reincarnated on earth very shortly after the death of the previous physical body. Since that time, this being has reappeared consistently throughout human history, becoming, as you can well imagine, the great helper of all those seeking to understand the mighty event of Palestine. After rediscovering his former ether body, Zarathustra, that is, the Zarathustra, began a new career, wandering through the millennia of human history as the being called Master Jesus, who reincarnated repeatedly to guide and direct the spiritual current we call Christianity. This being inspires all attempts to understand the living, evolving Christianity. In esoteric schools, he inspired the ongoing cultivation of Christian teachings. Behind the great spiritual figures of Christianity stood this figure, constantly teaching the true significance of the great event of Palestine. When Zarathustra's eye, which had enlivened the body of the Nathanic Jesus from its 12th to its 30th year, left that body, a different being incarnated. All the Gospels tell us that the highest eye replaced Zarathustra's when Jesus was baptized in the Jordan by John. In my lectures on the John Gospel, I pointed out that baptism at that time, and as John performed it, was something completely different from the mere symbol it later became. Candidates for baptism were totally submerged in the water. As you know from various preparatory anthroposophical lectures, this situation can provoke an extraordinary event. Even under normal circumstances, a person experiencing the shock of near drowning may see a great tableau of his or her life to date. This tableau, which normally appears only at death, surfaces briefly when the ether body rises out of the physical body and is freed from its forces. Most of those baptized by John underwent such an experience, and the Nathanic Jesus was no exception. When his ether body left his physical body, the exalted being we call the Christ descended into the Nathanic Jesus and took possession of his body. After baptism in the Jordan by John, therefore, the Nathanic Jesus was filled with the Christ being. This is the meaning of the words found in older manuscripts of the Gospels, quote, "This is my dearly beloved Son, today I have begotten him," close quote. The Son of Heaven, the Christ, had been conceived. The inseminator was the unitary divinity that weaves throughout the cosmos. The suitably prepared body and other constitutional members of the Nathanic Jesus received the divine seed from the heights. Quote, "This is my dearly beloved Son. Today I have begotten him." Close quote. This is what older manuscripts say, and what newer versions of the Gospels should also say. Luke 3:22. Who is the Christ being who united with the ether body of the Nathanic Jesus? We cannot understand him by looking only at earthly evolution, because he is the leader of the spiritual beings who separated from earth along with the sun in order to influence the earth from a higher external vantage point. Thus, in pre-Christian times, beginning with the sun's separation from earth, those who looked up at the sun with sufficiently mature perception experienced what Zarathustra taught, that the sunlight and warmth that reach us are only the physical garments of exalted spiritual beings behind the sunlight, garments that conceal the spiritual forces irradiating the earth. All these beings send their beneficial influences down to earth from the sun, and their leader is the being we call the Christ. In pre-Christian times, this being could be found only on the sun, not on earth. Zarathustra was right when he pointed to the sun as the dwelling place of the being called Ahura Mazda. Zarathustra said, "We cannot discover this being as we wander earth, but only when we look up at the sun. The spiritual being living in the sun is Ahura Mazda, and the light that streams down to us is his body, just as the physical human body is the body of the human spirit. Through great cosmic events, this exalted being gradually approached the sphere of earth. Clairvoyance could perceive his approach. The first clear recognition of the Christ occurred on Mount Sinai, when he was revealed to his great predecessor, Moses, in fire and lightning. What do these revelations signify? They were like a reflection of the approaching Christ being, the spiritual counterpart of the reflected sun rays we see at each full moon. The light shining toward us is sunlight, but we call it moonlight because it is reflected by the moon. Who did Moses see in the burning bush and in the fire on Mount Sinai? He saw the Christ. He saw the Christ's reflection, just as we see reflected sunlight when we look at the moon. We call this reflected sunlight moonlight, and the people of that time called the Christ's reflection Yahweh, or Jehovah. Just as sunlight announces its presence through moon rays at full moon, the Christ announced his presence indirectly because human beings could not yet perceive his actual being. Yahweh, or Jehovah, is the indirect, reflected light of the Christ before his appearance on earth. The Christ was destined to become ever more accessible to human perception and understanding. He was to live on earth, human among humans, revealing himself directly to all as he had previously revealed himself in the cosmos to initiates. Initiates with access to cosmic wisdom had always been aware of the Christ's existence, although they gave his different manifestations different names. To Zarathustra he revealed himself in garments of sunlight. So Zarathustra called him Ahura Mazda. The holy Rishis, the great teachers of humanity in ancient India, during the first epoch after the Atlantean catastrophe, were also aware of this being, but they knew that he would remain inaccessible to earthly wisdom until a later epoch. The seven Rishis said that he dwelt beyond their region and called him Vishvakarman. Vishvakarman and Ahura Mazda are different names for the same being, who was slowly approaching earth from the spiritual heights of the cosmos. Lengthy preparations were required to produce a body capable of receiving this being. First, Zarathustra's eye had to mature from incarnation to incarnation, eventually incarnating in the pure body of Jesus of Nazareth, to refine the faculties of a soul body, sentient soul, and mind soul to receive such an exalted being. The preliminary steps took a long time. To learn to transform the faculties of the Nathanic Jesus, Zarathustra's eye first had to undergo all the life experiences of several different incarnations. Furthermore, Zarathustra's eye could not have performed this transformation at any earlier time, because the Nathanic child Jesus had to be shaped not only by Zarathustra, but also by the exalted being we described as the Buddha's Nirmanakaya. But the Buddha's Nirmanakaya first had to exist. The Bodhisattva had to achieve Buddhahood before he could develop the spirit body, or Nirmanakaya, that would shape the Nathanic child Jesus between birth and puberty. Without first becoming a Buddha, the Bodhisattva would have lacked the strength to make that body sufficiently mature to support such a great occurrence. This capability developed only in the incarnation when the Bodhisattva became the Buddha. When we finally learn to understand the great wisdom preserved in ancient legends, we will find that they reflect the entire contents of the Akashic record in wondrous form. We are quite rightly told that as early as the ancient Indian epoch, human beings learned about the cosmic Christ being who dwelt outside the sphere of the seven holy Rishis. The Rishis knew that this being lived in the heights and was only gradually approaching earth. Zarathustra also knew that he had to turn to the sun to find this being. And the ancient Hebrews were the first to develop faculties that allowed them to perceive his reflection. Legend tells us that as the Bodhisattva was preparing to become a Buddha, he was approached by Vishvakarman, who would later be called the Christ. As the Bodhisattva's 29th year drew near, he made his first trip away from the palace, where such great care and attention had been lavished upon him. He soon met an old man, then a sick person, and then a corpse. So he became aware of life's misery. He saw age, sickness, and death personified in a monk who had just departed this life. At this point, so the legend tells us in its great wisdom, he would have returned to the palace if Vishvakarman, the artist of the gods, had not appeared to him. Vishvakarman, who would later be called the Christ, sent his own forces down to earth to adorn the young Bodhisattva. The Christ was still an external presence to the Bodhisattva, like Jesus of Nazareth at the baptism in the Jordan. The Bodhisattva was approaching his 30th year, but he was not mature enough to completely receive the Christ in his human body. In his life as the Buddha, he achieved this maturity. When he reappeared in his Nirmanakaya, or spiritual body, his task was to prepare the body of the Nathanic Jesus, which he himself did not inhabit, to receive Vishvakarman, or the Christ. All the forces of earth evolution worked together to bring about the great event of Christ's incarnation. At this point, we may wonder how the Christ, or Vishvakarman, relates to beings such as the Bodhisattvas, one of whom was the future Buddha. This question leads us to the brink of one of the greatest mysteries in earthly evolution. As a general rule, people with modern feelings and sensations have a great difficulty achieving even an inkling of the power behind this mystery. In the entire cosmos to which our earth belongs, there are 12 bodhisattvas. The one who became the Buddha 5 or 6 centuries before Christ was entrusted with the mission of teaching humankind to embody compassion and love. Just as his mission was to bring the doctrine of compassion and love to earth, each of the other bodhisattvas has a specific mission to accomplish in a different earthly epoch. The Buddha was especially close to the earth's overall mission because the development of moral attitudes was the task of our age, which extends from the time 5 or 6 centuries before Christ, when the bodhisattva appeared, to the time when he will be succeeded by the next bodhisattva, who will one day live on earth as the Maitreya Buddha. Earth evolution progresses because the bodhisattvas descend to earth at intervals to embody the contents of their mission. If we could survey the entire history of the earth, we would discover 12 bodhisattvas. As members of a mighty spiritual community, they are sent down to earth to serve as special messengers to humankind, as the great teachers of humanity. We must acknowledge the role of the Great Lodge of the 12 bodhisattvas in governing the entire evolution of the earth. On a higher plane, the bodhisattvas manifest the concept of teacher as we apply it on lower levels of existence. As teachers, they inspire specific faculties that human beings must acquire. What is the source of the content the bodhisattvas proclaim from epoch to epoch? If you could behold the circle of the 12 bodhisattvas in the Great Spirit Lodge, you would discover a thirteenth being sitting in their midst. This being, who cannot be called a teacher in the same sense as the 12, radiates the substance of wisdom itself. The 12 bodhisattvas in the Great Spirit Lodge sit around a central point, immersed in contemplation of the great being who exudes the wisdom that they are to incorporate into earthly evolution. The 13th being exudes what the other 12 will teach. The 12 are the teachers and inspirers who proclaim the presence of the 13th from epoch to epoch. The 13th is the very substance of their teaching. He is the ancient Rishi's Vishvakarman, Zarathustra's Ahura Mazda, and our Christ, the leader and guide of the great Bodhisattva Lodge. Thus the entire choir of bodhisattvas proclaims the doctrine of the Christ, or Vishvakarman. The bodhisattva who became the Buddha 5 or 6 centuries before Christ was adorned with the forces of Vishvakarman. The Nathanic Jesus who received the Christ was not merely adorned, but anointed, that is, pervaded by and imbued with Vishvakarman, the Christ. A symbol or image appears wherever people sense this great mystery or recognize it through initiation. Before the emergence of Christianity, for example, the little-known, highly secretive Draughton mysteries of northern Europe created an earthly symbol of the spiritual reality of the Lodge of the 12 Bodhisattvas. The Draughton mysteries of ancient Europe always included a community of 12 teachers whose task was to convey spiritual knowledge. These communities also had a 13th member, not a teacher, whose mere presence radiated the wisdom the others received. This was an earthly image of a heavenly spiritual reality. Titled The Mysteries, a poem that reflects Goethe's Rosicrucian inspiration, is another example of a community of 12 surrounding a 13th, who need not be a great teacher. In this poem, the monks hail the simple brother Marcus as the successor of their deceased 13th member. The task of the 13th is not to present teachings, but to be the teachings, to be spiritual substance itself. This has always been the case wherever people comprehend or divine this exalted reality. The baptism in the Jordan, therefore, represents the point in human evolution when spiritual substance itself, the heavenly 13th being, appeared on earth. All other beings, both bodhisattvas and buddhas, taught about this being, and mighty preparations were required so that he could descend into a human body. This is the mystery of the baptism in the Jordan. The Gospels describe Bhishvakarman, or Ahura Mazda, now called the Christ, in the body of the Nathanic Jesus. This being was to spend 3 years on earth as a human among humans, inhabiting a time-tested earthly entity with the 30 years of experience we described earlier. The Nathanic Jesus was irradiated and pervaded by a being who had previously been clothed in the radiant, warming sun rays shining down from the cosmos, a being who had left earth when the sun separated from it. There is another question we must ask, namely, why did this being unite with the earth's evolution at such a late stage? Why didn't he descend to earth earlier? Why couldn't he occupy a human ether body earlier, before the baptism in the Jordan? We will understand why once we understand more exactly the event the Old Testament describes as the fall. The event depicted symbolically as the fall into sin in paradise occurred in Lemurian times, when the human astral body was invaded by certain beings, the Luciferic beings, who had remained behind on the evolutionary level of the old moon. Because Luciferic forces invaded the human astral body, we humans became more deeply entangled in earthly affairs than we would have been otherwise. If we had not fallen under the influence of Lucifer, we would have completed our evolution on earth in higher spheres, as it were, less deeply involved in earthly matter. This influence made us descend to earth prematurely. If nothing else had happened to counteract the Luciferic forces that were in the human astral body, these forces would have invaded the ether body as well. As my book title, An Outline of Esoteric Science, describes from a different perspective, the cosmic powers took exceptional measures to prevent this invasion. Human beings could not be permitted to remain as they were once the astral body accepted the Luciferic forces. To protect the ether body from the effect of these forces, human beings were made incapable of using the entire ether body. A portion of the ether body was placed out of reach of free human will. Without this benevolent divine act, human beings would have retained power over the entire ether body and would not have been able to continue to evolve appropriately on earth. Certain aspects of the human ether body were rescued and saved for a later time. Let's attempt to view these with the eyes of the Spirit. The human being includes the same states of matter that we find in the world outside us, the earthly or solid element, the watery or liquid element, and the airy or gaseous element. These elements constitute the human physical body and all other physical objects. The etheric domain begins with the first ether state, which we call the fire ether, or simply fire. Fire or warmth, which modern physics sees as mere movement rather than as substance, is really the first ether state. The second is the light ether, or light. And the third, imperceptible to us in its original form, is the finer etheric or spiritual element that underlies physical sound. The sound we perceive in the physical world is a mere reflection or shadow of this ether state, the sound or number ether. The fourth ether state is the life ether, which underlies all life as such. In the constitution of the modern human, all aspects of the soul leave imprints on the physical and etheric bodies. Each soul force is assigned to a specific etheric substance, so to speak. What we call human will is expressed in the etheric element of fire. If you are even slightly receptive to the connections between certain sensations, you will sense that we are right in speaking about the way, in speaking about the will in this way. The will, which expresses itself physically in the blood, or in the movement of the blood, lives in the etheric fire element, while what we call feeling is expressed in the light ether within the ether body. This is why clairvoyants perceive human will impulses as flames flickering in the ether body and radiating into the astral body, while they perceive feelings as shapes made of light. As you can easily imagine, the thoughts we experience in our souls and express in the sounds of our words are mere shadowy images of thinking, because physical sound is also only a shadow image of a higher sound element, the sound ether that includes the organ for words. Our words, in turn, are underlain by thoughts. That is, words are means of expressing thoughts. These means of expression fill etheric space by sending their vibrations through the sound ether. Sound, however, is only a shadow of actual thought vibrations. But the inner aspect that gives our thoughts meaning belongs to the life ether. There's a little chart left to right: meaning, life ether; thinking, sound ether. Then there's a division, and then below that, feeling, light ether; will, fire ether; and below fire ether then is air, water, earth. Of these four states of ether, only the lower two, the fire ether and the light ether, remained accessible to free human will in Lemurian times, while the two upper types were taken away from us, that is, sound ether and life ether were taken away. This is the inner meaning of the passage in Genesis. Human beings, having learned to distinguish between good and evil, symbolized by eating of the tree of knowledge, under the influence of the Luciferic forces, had to be prevented from eating from the tree of life. That is, the part of the ether body that has free and independent access to the thought ether and the meaning ether was taken away from us, and only feeling and will remained subject to free choice. As a result, we can each express personal will and personal feelings. Feeling and willing remain freely accessible to the personal element in each human being, so our feelings and will impulses are individually different. The individual impulse stops short, however, when we rise from the feeling level to the thinking level, or even to the expression of thinking, that is, to words on the physical plane. Feelings and intentions are personal matters for each of us, but we immediately enter a universal element when we rise into the world of words and thoughts. We cannot each make our own thoughts. If thoughts were as individual as feelings, we would never understand each other. Thus thought and meaning were removed from the realm of human free will and temporarily preserved in the sphere of the gods, to be returned to human beings later. Wherever we go on the face of the earth, we find individual human beings with individual feelings and will impulses. But thinking is the same everywhere, and each ethnic group shares a common language governed by a common folk spirit. This sphere is inaccessible to human will. For now, the gods work into it. When Zarathustra and his pupils pointed toward the kingdom of the spirit, they were right in calling the warmth or fire and light that streamed down from heaven the garments of Ahura Mazda. These garments, however, conceal an undescended element that remains in spiritual heights, casting only a shadow into physical human thoughts and words. The sun's warmth and light conceal the living aspects of sound and meaning, which are disclosed only to those who see behind the light. These living aspects relate to the earthly word as the heavenly word relates to the aspects of life that have been rescued temporarily from humankind. That is why Zarathustra told his pupils to look up to Ahura Mazda, to see how he reveals himself in the physical garments of light and warmth, which conceal the divine word of creation that is approaching the earth. What is Vishwakarman? What is Ahura Mazda? What is the Christ in his true form but the divine word of creation? Strange as it may seem, Zoroastrianism tells us that Zarathustra was initiated so that he could perceive, standing behind the light, not only Ahura Mazda but also Hanover, the divine word of creation that was to descend to earth. During the baptism in the Jordan, this word descended into an individual human ether body for the first time. The spirit word that had been preserved since Lemurian times streamed down from the heights into the ether body of the Nathanic Jesus. When the baptism was completed, the word had become flesh. From the very beginning, Zarathustra and other seers who knew his secrets proclaim the presence of the word that is concealed behind warmth and light. These, in quotes, independent seers became the, in quotes, servants of the word, whose proclamations are recorded in the Luke Gospel. This example demonstrates again that the Gospels must be taken literally. The element that had been denied human beings for so long because of their involvement with Lucifer first became flesh, descending to earth and living on earth in a single personality. This being is the great ideal to be emulated by all those who slowly learn to understand his nature. This is why our earthly wisdom must follow the example of the bodhisattvas, whose task is always to proclaim the 13th in their midst. We must apply all our spiritual science, our wisdom, our knowledge, and the results of spiritual research to comprehending the being and nature of Vishwakarman, Ahura Mazda, or the Christ. The end of Lecture 7, given in Basel on September 20th, 1909.